It is Harvest Thanksgiving Sunday, and that is a brilliant display just of different examples of things that we've been given. A lot of tin stuff. And for the younger kids, I guess if you said to them, where does food come from, they'd probably say Sainsbury's. But the fact is that we know that Sainsbury's had to get it from somewhere, and the truth is it's grown, and it's grown because God has made it grow. That is what Christians believe, and as I've said already, most of that material is going to go on to Romania to relieve some of the poverty that is going on in some situations there. But we're also asking today, not just Thanksgiving Sunday of harvest, but we're asking this question, is anyone there? In other words, how do you know that there is anyone to say thank you to for harvest or anything else? It's all very well me saying that God has made these things grow, but how do we know there is a God? Lots and lots and lots of people in Chippenham today would, if you pin them down, I think, believe in God, but why? Is there anyone there? As we discussed with the children earlier on, if we're going to be able to answer the question, then we need to be several things. We need to be interested enough and to stop and consider the evidence. That's the first thing we need to do. We need to give our minds to the question. And people will say, well, it doesn't matter. That's another one of those questions. Why should I care? We'll deal with that after Christmas. But we need to consider the evidence. And we need to be sensible to draw the conclusions that the evidence points to. This is not just a game of Cluedo. This is a game not even of life or death. It's more important than football, to coin the phrase that football's more important than life or death. No, no, it's a matter of eternity. The question like this, all we can do this morning is to consider the key evidence. And we're going to ask other questions at latter points in our series. So let's start to think through at least some of the evidence to answer the question, is anyone there? I've got 5 bits of evidence I want to put to you this morning, and I'd be very happy to chat to you about it afterwards. And indeed, we run a little course called Christianity Explored that we're due to start another one of shortly. And if you're interested really in thinking through this evidence, then Christianity Explored will help you. See, the first evidence that when you open something like the Bible, which is the Christian book from God, we would believe, the first evidence is the evidence of creation. Some people insist that actually creation is no evidence at all. Richard Dawkins and others would insist that God is merely delusion and that what we call creation is little more than just a collection of kind of chemical accidents, little more than a series of complex accidents which resulted in what we now see and know. But if there is a God, and he has revealed himself to us, and if there's going to be any revelation, then it's going to have to be his initiative, because he's so much bigger than we are. We're never going to get his attention any other way, any more than an ant would get my attention. If there is a God, then according to the Bible, he has chosen to start with creation. That is how he introduces himself. Let me just scan you through a few pages of the Bible. No need to turn these up. But look at the opening verse of the Bible. It says this: in the beginning, God created in the heavens and the earth. That's how he introduces himself. In one of the Psalms, Psalm 19, it says, the heavens declare the glory of God, and it is the skies that proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day, they pour forth speech. Night after night, they display knowledge. There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard. When you look up to the sky, the very sunshine or the stars, says the Bible, cries, there is a God. It's obvious, says the Bible. Look at Jonah, of Jonah and the whale fame. And as he's on the boat, and the pagan seamen are about to throw him into the water to be swallowed by a whale, or actually it says a big fish. You'll at least know the children's story, if not the true account from the Bible. The pagan sailors say to him, tell us about the God that you know. And Jonah says this, that makes them shake. He says, I worship the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and land. How do I introduce God? Well, he made everything, is what Jonah says. And the Apostle Paul, after his Damascus Road experience, wanted to introduce God to the great philosophy debating chamber in Athens. Paul said, the God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth. And he does not live in temples built by human hands. And again, the Apostle Paul, writing on this very question to the Christians in Rome, said, "Since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what is made, so that men are without excuse." See, the point is this, that Richard Dawkins may not think so, but the Bible insists that the God of the Bible wants us to recognize that creation itself tells us all about him. You can't get away from it. If you're somebody that opens the Bible to look for God, you will find God insists that he made it and you in the first place. Now, we could this morning get into the discussion of evolution. And the problem, of course, is that the apparent evolution, known by scientists as a theory, which is something that cannot be proved, and pushed by the media as a fact, which is something that can't be disagreed with. Remember, it's the theory of evolution. We haven't got time this morning to go into all the detail. I am a scientist. I'm quite prepared to discuss it with any of you afterwards, if you like. But let's cut to the chase. Even if evolution were true, and by the way, I don't believe it is, but even if it were true, and all life occurred as some chemical accident in a primeval swamp, and even if that swamp came as a result of the chemical bubbling and conundrum of the cooling of our solar system, and even if the solar system came by about as an accident of the Big Bang, and even if you accept that the laws of physics didn't come into being until moments after the Big Bang. By the way, when you set aside the laws of physics, we normally call those things a miracle, by the way, just in case you haven't noticed. So the Big Bang would be a miracle if it did happen, by the way. Even if you accept all of those things, you still haven't answered the question, what went bang? Have you? Or why? And all you have is guesswork and supposition. Because you want the answer to be chance. There is no evidence except that which you choose to interpret in a certain way. And as some cosmologists do, when you say to them what went bang, in a very snooty way, they kind of laugh down their noses and say, ho, 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 of course the answer to that is a certain kind of peculiarity. Do you know what that means? No, neither do they. A certain kind of peculiarity means we don't know. So we'll give it chance another name and pin our hopes upon it. In other words, when everything is said and done, you pull it all the way down to the Big Bang. What went bang? I have to have faith to believe that nothing went bang, is what the answer is. That's what it boils down to. It is a faith position. And what makes this particularly important is that it is just a belief in a matter of faith, nothing more or less. And can I say that it is a weak faith, because it is faith in silence. And arguments from silence are usually the weakest ones, aren't they? What makes this particularly important is because in all of this creation, there is another piece of evidence to the question, is anyone there? And the other piece of evidence is this one, the evidence of design. That's a snowflake when it comes up. A microscopic picture of a snowflake. Apparently that was an accident. So they say. The Bible says that rather than chance, we know and see, and our very selves were created. Just look at some of the evidence for design. I've mentioned the solar system and the world in which we live. Did you know that the Earth orbits the sun at an orbit which is slightly elliptical, but give or take a tiny bit, it is 92.8 million miles away from the sun. That particular orbit happens to be perfect, given the size of our sun and the size of our planet, for life to exist. If the orbit were just very slightly closer in, global warming would have taken off thousands of years ago, and no life could be sustained, whether it came by evolution or any other means. And if you don't believe that's true, look at Venus, which is where it rains sulfuric acid and is hot and fearsome. If it were very slightly further away from the sun, then there would be an ice age that could never melt, and no life could exist. And if you don't believe that that is true, go to Mars, where the average temperature is below zero all of the time. The Earth tilts on an axis as it goes round the sun. Do you know if that tilt were just very slightly one way or the other, either there would be no polar ice caps and the equator would be unbearably hot, or the equator would be freezing cold and the polar ice caps would extend over a vast proportion of the Earth in an ice age. Now, when you look at the Earth, just as an example, does it look like an accident to you, or does it look like it's been put there on purpose? Far from being arguing for a flat Earth, the Bible describes the Earth in the book of Isaiah as being a circle. In other words, a sphere. It describes people as being fearfully and wonderfully made. You only need to look at one piece of the human body, for example, the eye, to see the intricacy of design. Look in the mirror when you get home. Have a look at your eye. In the back of your eye are 126 million light-receiving cells. 100 million of those light-receiving cells pick up black and white, and they share 20 to a nerve, nerves to the brain. Of the other 26 million, the other 26 million are all colour receivers. Each one has its own nerve to the brain. Could that have been an accident of chemistry? In the natural world, there are millions of examples like that. The evidence is summed up rather well by a 200-year-old analogy in the example of a watch. Imagine you went out this afternoon on a beautiful sunny afternoon, like this afternoon they tell us may well be, albeit slightly cold. And you're walking along a country path and you come across something you've not seen before. Now, you and I have all seen a watch, haven't we? But pretend for a second you'd never seen a watch before. And there lying on the ground is a watch, a beautiful pocket watch, one of those gold ones that you wind up and you pick it up. And because you're an inquisitive sort of a person, you unscrew the back, and as you look in the back, you see tiny workings and cogs and everything moving and the tick gradually going. Would you for a moment have believed that that just happened by an accident? Or would you naturally assume, given no other evidence, that it had occurred by design? That someone had put the bits and bobs there on purpose so that they worked perfectly? Of course, the answer is obvious. You would know that a watch came there by design, wouldn't you? And yet the human body, as I've just illustrated, and all of the natural order is many, many millions of times more complex than a watch. There are many hundreds of scientists who believe in design. If you don't believe me, go home and check out the Christians in Science website. If you don't believe me. Several of the Christians on there are fellows of the Royal Society, the highest acknowledged qualification that a scientist in this country can get. There are millions of people who believe in design. And there is a simple and profound concept in science that makes the point rather well. If something looks like a banana, smells like a banana, feels like a banana, and tastes like a banana, the probability is that it is a banana. It's obvious, isn't it? It might just be an elaborate hoax or a carefully formed ice cream, but the probability is that it's a banana. So is anyone there? If there is a God, then what does the question mean anyway? See, if there is no God, actually one of the strongest problems that you have is the whole idea of meaning. If there is no God, why bother in the first place? If there is no God, what is anything for? In the Bible, in the book of Ecclesiastes, tackles this question head on. That's why I wanted you all to have Bibles, so you could look at the book of Ecclesiastes with me briefly. You find it in the first half of the Bible, the Old Testament, and it's on page 469, if you're using one of the blue Bibles from the table at the back. The Bible isn't shy to big questions. And this whole book of Ecclesiastes, one of the 66 books of the Bible, tackles this question of meaning right where it hurts. page 469. This is the words of the teacher, the son of David, the king of Jerusalem, is the introduction. And he says, meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless, everything is meaningless. He's looking at the idea of life, the perspective of life under the sun, with no God. What does man gain from all his labour at which he toils under the sun? Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever, more or less. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning to its course. All the streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, they return again. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. What has will be again, and what has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? It was already here. Long ago it was here from before our time. There is no remembrance of men of old. And even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow. What a dismal chapter of the Bible. But you see, it's making the point very clearly that if everything is just an accident, if it's all just an accident of chemistry, if there is no God, then there is no ultimate purpose to anything, no ultimate direction and no future goal. As people, life is simply an endless cycle of chemical interactions, one bubbling set of chemicals interacting with another bubbling set of chemicals until one of them stops working and it dies. And then it just goes round again, back to where it came from. People are born, they grow up, they get married, they have babies and they die. And those babies grow up, they get married, they have babies and they die. And so on, and so on, and so on. A cycle repeated, but why? You go to work to earn the money, to buy the food, to come home to eat. You know what for? So that you can go to work to earn the money, to buy the food, to come home to eat. So you can go to work to earn the money, to buy the food, to come home to eat, and so on, and so on, and so on. Life is just one big endless cycle of existence. And sure, it's interspersed with happy and sad times. But if there is no God and it's all just an accident, then particularly for those suffering or in circumstances that mean they cannot have or look forward to happy times, what is the point? Why bother? When you interact with some of the most poor people in the world, then they don't have the kind of luxury to look forward to of holidays and new tellies and that kind of thing that we have in this country. They just have one miserable existence, day to another, to another, to another. If there's no God, why do they bother? If it's all just an accident, and when one day end in a big crash, which is where the Big Bang supposedly will go, depending on who you talk to, it's all just going to wait for another certain peculiarity. Remember what that means. So that it can all happen again in billions of years, then actually everything is meaningless. And can I say to you that the very statement, there is no God, is meaningless. And every other statement is meaningless. Everything becomes meaningless if it's all just an accident. There's no meaning for life under the sun if there is no God. If you look back at the history of philosophy, you find that certain people have come to exactly that conclusion. We're going to talk about them in a moment. To find meaning, you need another perspective. And indeed, the book of Ecclesiastes, which I asked you to turn to a few moments ago, having rehearsed what I've just said in copious detail, there are 12 chapters of this as it works through different points of life, comes right to the end and says this right at the end. Page 475. He says, verse 13, now all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Remember, he's looked at life under the sun with no God. He says, the conclusion is fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man, for God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. In other words, there is meaning. There is God. So is anyone there? If there isn't, then how do you decide what is right and what is wrong? How can you define good and evil? If there isn't a God, then how do you decide morality? Actually, morality itself is evidence for God. In any useful universal measurement, for it to be useful, it needs to have an absolute standard. So I could have chosen the pound, but trying to be modern, I've picked the kilogram as an example. You know what a kilogram is? Anyone want to tell me? What does a kilogram stand for? How do you work out a kilogram? 2.2 pounds, somebody's going to say, aren't they? Well, it's the weight of exactly 1 litre of water. How do you measure a litre of water? You get a kilogram and you can put... No, that's not how you do it, actually. How can we be sure that one set of scales is the same as another? And the answer is that in France, in the International Bureau of Weights and Measures, there is a block of platinum iridium alloy that is called, is a great name for this, the International Prototype Kilogram. It's stored in a vault. I suspect that vault is in a vacuum. And it's absolutely perfect. All other kilograms in the world are taken from that one measure. So your scales has been compared with the weight that was compared with the weight that was compared with the weight that was compared with that one in the International Bureau of Weights and Measures in France. That's how we know what a kilogram is. It is an absolute standard. All other kilogram weights are measured according to that one. And there's something similar for distance, and there's something similar for volume, and so on, and temperature, and so on, and so on. So, that's all very well for physical things. How do we decide an absolute standard for what is right and wrong? For good and evil? How do you decide that? What is the standard? If there is no God, then the standard is presumably something like the common good. But who decides what is good? And indeed, if there is no God, then my definition of good is presumably just as valid as your definition of good. And if my definition of good means I can come up and punch you on the nose, then who's to say I'm wrong? Other than you. And if me and my mates think that we can outnumber you and punch you on the nose, who's going to argue and tell us we're wrong? Do you see the effect of the removal of God? And if that all sounds rather nonsensical, let me tell you that we have lived through a century where exactly that theory affected everything that we see and know today. It was a German philosopher, Friedrich Nietzsche, who concluded that his non-belief in God entitled him to both campaign against Christian morality and for his own rather different, oppressive morality. It was him who said the famous statement, God is dead. I might just tell you, there was a famous piece of art in New York where someone had said, God is dead, Nietzsche. And someone else had scribbled underneath, Nietzsche is dead, God. But it's actually rather sad when you think about it. Nietzsche decided that his version of morality, which involved masters and slaves, and what he defined as good for the masters, and he defined as ill, which was for the slaves. It was Nietzsche and his ideas of God, no God to answer to, and of a master race in turn, that led to the terrible ideas embraced by Adolf Hitler, and the millions of people oppressed and murdered across Europe in the Second World War. Now you may say, oh, that's rather an extreme example, but my colleague, Chai, met in an open-air meeting in Chippenham just the other day, somebody who described themselves as a nihilist. Not a nihilist. And somebody who holds on to nihilist philosophy essentially embraces the idea there is no God, there is no meaning, there is nothing, and Friedrich Nietzsche was right, whatever right means. See, if there is no God, who is anyone to say that Adolf Hitler was wrong? Do you see the point? But there is a God, and he declares that such horror to be wrong. It is he who sets an absolute standard, and you and I know that is true. So I referred earlier on to the Apostle Paul, after his Damascus Road experience, wrote to the Roman Christians and said, of pagan people, he said, pagan people show that the requirements of the law, in other words, the requirements of what it means to know God, that it's written on their hearts. Their consciences bear witness, their thoughts accuse and defend them. Each of us has an inbuilt sense of what is right and wrong, and that is because, as the Bible says, in fact, in that book of Ecclesiastes, it says he has also set eternity in the hearts of men. I might tell you Friedrich Nietzsche was eventually locked up as a lunatic, unsurprisingly, because he went completely bananas, because the conclusion he drew that if there is no God, then there is nothing else. And you know that there is right and wrong. You know, when we suppress the truth about God, either about his existence or his nature, what we're actually doing is putting ourselves as the masters of right and wrong. We're the ones who are defining what is good and evil, and saying that we make up our own minds. And you and I can see that that is exactly what is happening in our society right now, where people are just making up their own minds. The existence of morality is evidence for God, and its absence indicates a denial of him. Some people say to me, is there anyone there? It's all very well talking about creation and meaning and so on. But is there anyone there? I'll tell you what they say to me. If I would believe in God if only I could see him and meet him in the flesh. And when people say that to me, I always want to say, you're too late. If you'd been walking around Palestine just a couple of thousand years ago in AD 30, then you could have walked up to him if you could have got through the crowds and you could have shaken his hand. Because actually, possibly the strongest evidence of all for the existence of God is Jesus. See, if there is a God, what would he be like? What would he be like? Can you imagine? Distant and uninterested and distracted and not caring about you or anything else? Or despotic and nasty and cruel and malicious? And if he lived for eternity, you'd think he'd get bored, wouldn't you? Like the Roman or Greek gods supposedly were. Or how about just and holy and loving? The historical figure Jesus Christ, for whom there is copious evidence of his existence in non-Christian writings, let alone in the Bible. The historical figure Jesus Christ claimed that he was God. Turn with me, the last thing, to John's Gospel, which is John, the disciple John's account of Jesus' life. You'll find it towards the second half of the Bible, on page, if you're using a blue Bible, page 748. There are four biographies of Jesus written in the Bible, Matthew and Mark and Luke and John, each written from different perspectives by different people. And can I say they complement one another? The Apostle John wrote this in verse 14 of the first chapter, down on the left-hand side of the page, describing Jesus as the Word, the idea, the concept, the meaning, the one who spoke. It's a big title to give him. He says, the Word became flesh, God became flesh, and made his dwelling among us. And we have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. Flick over just a few pages to chapter 3 and you'll see Jesus saying, just chapter 3 and verse 16. You'll see Jesus himself saying, God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish but have eternal life. For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world through him. Turn over a few more pages to chapter 14, and you'll find Jesus describing himself in these remarkable terms. Page 761 and verse 6 there on the right-hand side of the page. He answered, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. And in a remarkable statement, if you let your eye drop down to verse 9, he could say to his disciples, anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. Here is God in the flesh. That's what he claims to be. The most compelling evidence for God that there could be. Now what do you do with Jesus? Because even if you dismiss all the other stuff, what do you do with Jesus? We date our year. Every time you write your calendar, you date your year from his birth and death and resurrection. Someone has described Jesus as being either mad or bad or God. If you read those four different accounts of his life story, then it's very difficult to add up that he was a madman. Isn't it? If you read the teachings and the kindness, and however much you want to argue that his disciples skewed the evidence, even the non-Christian writings talk about how he helped people. It's difficult to describe Jesus as a bad man. You wouldn't draw that conclusion naturally. But if you read the account of his life and what he did and what he said and who he was and the impact that he's had on society and the change that he's given in individual lives and the fact that he now, more than 2,000 years later, was sitting in a building talking about him, I want to argue that it is evidence for him to be the God-man. If there is a God, you see, then he is not the God of religion who throws out a set of rules and says to these squirming human beings, right, man, work your way up to me, and if you've earned enough points, I might just know you and let you into heaven. I might wait for you to do some dramatic act of suicide or service or something else to let you into my glory. Now that's not the God I want to know. And frankly, it's not the God of the Bible. Now, the God of the Bible, the Christian God, the only God that is there, for whom there is overwhelming evidence, is the God who knowing our state and rejection and confusion and rebellion, has stepped into humanity and lifted us up. And even to meet his justice, taking the punishment for our rebellion and our ignorance of him, he died on a cross, taking that punishment for us, and rose again 3 days later from the dead. We can talk about that as well, for the evidence of that, if you like. But let me summarize it by quoting a Lord Chief Justice of England who said, "There is more evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead than for the existence of Julius Caesar." What's it going to be? Is anyone there? On the balance of probability, I think the answer is overwhelming. There's another slide. Thank you. The answer is overwhelming. We haven't dealt with the evidence of history. We haven't dealt with the questions about the Bible. We haven't dealt with properly with the question of people's changed lives and so many other bits of evidence as well. But in answer to the question, is anyone there? The answer is yes, there is a God. And he has loved you and me so much that he set all this evidence so that you and I can know him and be loved by him. And in coming in the person of Jesus, he made it possible for us to really know him and to be forgiven for our ignoring him and to know him for life and for eternity in heaven. My prayer today is that all of us will consider the evidence and find it compelling and in our hearts say, God, I know you're there. Please bring me to know you. Please forgive me for my ignorance of you. Thank you that Jesus took the punishment for my rebellion. Please make me one of those who, as the Bible defines us, is a Christian.